Imagine you're standing at the edge of, say, a massive, sprawling playground. You're watching your kid play, and you feel that very specific, universal parental tension. You want them to run, you want them to climb, to be free, but you also have this, like, invisible tether in your mind, and you're absolutely terrified they might go just a little too far.
It's the classic paradox, isn't it? We want to give them roots and wings, but, you know, secretly, we're terrified the wings will work a little too well.
Exactly. Now, I want you to take that feeling and amplify it by, I don't know, a factor of 10, maybe 100.
Wow.
That is the reality we are unpacking today for families with autistic children or teens. For these parents, letting go isn't just an emotional hurdle. It is a massive logistical challenge.
Right. A huge one. We're talking about wandering, sensory overload, high-stakes emergency response.
Because safety in this context isn't just about, you know, preventing a scraped knee.
No, it's about preventing a child from getting lost in a city or a teen having a meltdown on a subway car because the train just stopped unexpectedly. The stakes are, they're incredibly high.
So on this deep dive, we're looking at a stack of research and guides all focused on one big question. How do we move beyond helicopter parenting, which, let's be honest, nobody wants to do.
Nobody.
And use technology to create a safety net that actually increases their autonomy.
It's a really fascinating shift in thinking.
Yeah.
We're moving away from this idea of surveillance, like, you know, just watching for the sake of watching.
Right.
And we're moving toward the idea of a digital safety net that actually allows the child to step out into the world more.
We've got some really comprehensive guides here. They focus specifically on autism locator devices, but also on safety strategies for public transport. And a lot of the insights are drawn from data around a service called Angel Sense. So let's get into it.
Let's do it.
First, we have to talk about the why. Because I think a lot of people might assume, oh, you know, just keep a better eye on your kid. But there's a statistic in our source material that actually made me gasp.
I know the one you're talking about.
Approximately 50% of people with autism attempt to elope or wander off at some point.
It's a staggering number. Half. And it's so crucial to understand the motivation here. This isn't usually about a child running away from home because they're unhappy or, you know, rebellious.
Right. It's not that traditional running away from home scenario.
No. It's often goal-directed. They see water. They see a train. They see something that just fascinates them, and they go. Or, on the flip side, they're trying to escape a sensory trigger, a loud noise, a bright light, a crowd. They're fleeing discomfort.
And the sources really emphasize that this is not a failure of supervision, which I think is a really, really important point to make.
It's the most important point.
Yeah.
There's so much guilt that gets associated with this, but the literature points out that wandering often happens in what they call the 60-second window.
60 seconds.
You turn around to stir pasta, answer the phone, help another kid tie their shoe. In those 60 seconds, because there often isn't a typical sense of danger, a child can just slip out the door. Visual supervision alone is not fail-safe.
Which brings us to the tech. Now, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Please do.
When I read about specialized locator devices, my first thought, and I think it's the first thought for a lot of our listeners, is, okay, but why? You know, I have an AirTag on my keys. My kid has an iPhone. We all have GPS in our pockets. Why do we need some special, often more expensive device? Why isn't an AirTag enough?
I'm really glad you asked that, because this is where the marketing of consumer tech meets the hard reality of safety.
Okay.
The sources break down exactly why things like AirTags or the Samsung SmartTag or even just regular smartphone apps often fail in these specific high-risk situations. And it really starts with how the technology itself works.
All right, so let's unpack the AirTag first. Those are everywhere.
So an AirTag is just a Bluetooth tracker. It doesn't have its own GPS chip connecting to a satellite. It relies entirely on the Apple Find My network. It basically just shouts out a little Bluetooth signal and hopes another iPhone is nearby to hear it and then report its location to the cloud.
It's crowdsourced location.
Exactly. Now, imagine a child wanders away from a school playground and ends up in a wooded area or an empty construction site or even just a rural road. If there are no other iPhones around to get that ping,
the map just goes dark.
It goes dark. You get that message. Last seen 20 minutes ago. In a wandering scenario, a 20-minute gap is, well, it's dangerous. It effectively stops working right when you need it the most.
And there's no history, right?
No history of where they've been, which is critical for understanding their patterns or just finding them if they're moving fast.
Okay, that makes sense for the tags. But what about a smartphone? My teen has an iPhone. We've got Life 360 or something on it. That has real GPS.
It does, but that solution has two major flaws, what I call agency and update frequency. First, a smartphone requires the child to manage it. They have to keep it charged, keep it with them, not lose it. And if a child is in a meltdown or a state of panic, they might drop the phone. They might not hear it ringing.
And the update
This
frequency.
is so critical. Most of those consumer apps update your location every few minutes. They do that to save battery.
Sure.
And if you're tracking a pizza delivery, 5 minutes is fine. But if your child is wandering toward a busy intersection or a body of water, 5 minutes is an eternity.
So you're always seeing where they were, not where they are.
Precisely. The specialized devices we're looking at, like AngelSense, are designed to update every few seconds when you put them in an emergency mode. That difference, real time versus a few minutes ago, is the difference between an interception and a search party.
So, if consumer tech is kind of the wrong tool for this specific job, what does the right tool look like? The sources outline what they call the anatomy of a safety net. What are the features that actually matter?
Well, the first one they point to is intelligent geofencing.
How is that any different from me just drawing a circle around my house on a map?
Standard geofencing is just that, a static circle. They leave the circle, you get a ding. But these intelligent systems, as the source describes them, they're proactive. They learn the child's routine.
Oh, I see.
They know that at 8 a.m., the child should be at school. If the child isn't at school or leaves a normal area at an unexpected time, the alert is immediate.
So it's monitoring for a deviation from the routine, not just a location.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It takes the burden off the parent to constantly be checking the map. You don't have to be glued to your screen. The system just nudges you when something is wrong.
That's a huge mental load off. Okay, the second big feature mentioned was indoor versus outdoor. I didn't even realize that was a thing until I read this. Why does that matter?
It's a massive technical hurdle. GPS works by having a line of sight to satellites in the sky. So it works great outdoors.
But the second you walk into a big shopping mall.
Or a concrete school building or a subway station, yeah. GPS signals just bounce around or they get blocked completely.
So the dot on the map starts jumping all over the place, or it just freezes.
Right. A purpose-built device needs to automatically switch from GPS to, say, Wi-Fi sniffing or Bluetooth beacons specifically for indoor accuracy. It allows you to know not just that they're at the mall, but potentially which wing of the mall they're in.
Now, this next feature, this was the one where I kind of paused, the assistive speakerphone. The ability for a parent to auto answer the device.
This is probably the most distinct difference between a simple tracker and a true safety device.
But I have to ask, and I'm sure listeners are thinking this, isn't that a bit invasive? The ability to just drop in and listen.
It definitely sounds that way if you view it through a neurotypical lens, but you have to put it in the context of the safety needs of this community.
Okay.
Imagine your child has wandered and is hiding under a slide at a park. They're scared. Or maybe they're on a bus that's going the wrong way. If you call their phone, they have to physically pick it up. They have to swipe, put it to their ear, and say, "Hello?"
Which, if they're nonverbal or in the middle of sensory overload, might be impossible.
Exactly. It's just not going to happen. The assistive speakerphone lets the parent auto pick up. You call the device, and it just answers automatically on speaker. You can speak to your child immediately, "Hey, I'm here. I see you. Stay right there," without them needing to do a single thing.
Okay, I see. That makes sense. It creates a voice bridge when the child can't build one
It
themselves.
does, and it also allows for that listen-in function you mentioned.
Right.
If you can't find them, you can listen to the environment. Do you hear traffic? Do you hear the echo of a gym? Do you hear wind? That audio cue can be the final clue that helps you find them.
But what about at school? I can't imagine teachers are thrilled about a device that can listen in during math class. That seems like a privacy nightmare for the other students.
That is a very valid concern, and the sources address it directly with something called school mode. It's non-negotiable for most school districts. Essentially, during school hours, the voice and listening features are automatically disabled. It respects privacy, avoids disrupting the class, but the location tracking remains active.
So the safety net is still there, but the distraction isn't.
Exactly. It's about balancing the safety needs of the individual child with the privacy rights of the entire classroom.
Okay, so we've established the safety net for, you know, the younger years or for those who are prone to wandering. But I want to pivot to the second part of our deep dive, which I found really inspiring. We're talking about the teenage years.
The transition years, a whole different ball game.
Yes. The sources describe public transportation as this massive gateway to independence.
It really is. I mean, for many autistic teens, driving might not be an option, at least not right away. So if they want to get a job or go to community college or just hang out with friends, the bus or the subway becomes their lifeline. It is literally how they access the world.
But the stats here are, well, they're pretty daunting. The source cites a study where 87% of autistic travelers experience sensory overload on public transit. 81% feel anxious.
And it makes perfect sense when you think about it. Public transit is, you know, organized chaos.
Yeah.
It's loud noises, screeching brakes, unpredictable delays, crowded spaces where people are touching you.
And it demands really high executive function.
Oh, incredibly high.
Yeah.
You have to remember the route, manage your time, handle payment, and crucially, you have to know what to do when the unexpected happens.
Right.
The bus doesn't show up, the train skips your stop. That unpredictability is absolute kryptonite for someone who relies so heavily on routine.
So how do we tackle this? The guide lays out a strategy that I thought was just brilliant. It's almost like flight training. They call it the dry run method.
Yes, and this is where we move from just tech to actual technique. You don't just put a teen on a bus and wave goodbye and hope for the best.
No.
You build the skill in phases.
So walk us through the phases. What's phase one?
Phase one is all about planning. You sit down together at home in a calm environment, no stress yet. You map out the route using apps. You look at the actual stops on Google Street View so they look familiar.
Ah, smart.
And you create a social story, which is basically a narrative script of what the whole trip will look like from start to finish.
So they know the theory before they have to face the reality.
Right. Then phase two is traveling together. But, and this is key, doing it during low traffic hours. You don't want their first solo trip to be rush hour on a Friday.
Of course not.
You go when it's quiet. You point out the landmarks, you practice tapping the payment card, you rehearse the what-ifs.
And then phase three, this sounded like the hardest part for the parents.
Phase three is shadowing. And yeah, this requires nerves of steel from the parent. The teen navigates the entire trip and the parent follows, but at a distance.
Like a ghost.
Maybe a few rows back on the bus or even in the next car on the train.
Yeah.
You are there as a safety net, but you do not intervene unless it is absolutely necessary. You have to let them swipe the card wrong. You have to let them find the seat. You have to let them feel that anxiety and overcome it.
It's like training wheels for the real world.
It is. It lets the teen feel the autonomy of navigating, but they know that if they truly panic, help is 10 feet away. They get the credit for the success.
But even with all that practice, the environment itself can still be the enemy. The noise, the lights. So let's talk about the commute toolkit. The sources suggest a go bag for sensory regulation.
This is so essential. If you can't control the environment, you have to control your reaction to it. And the kit should have noise-canceling headphones. That's practically mandatory.
Non-negotiable.
Sunglasses to cut down on the visual glare. Fidget tools.
And weighted items.
Yes, or weighted items. Anything that helps manage that stress response. If a teen feels that wave of anxiety starting because the bus is getting crowded, having a familiar texture to touch or a weighted lap pad can ground them just enough to stay on the bus.
Now let's get into the digital tools in that toolkit, the navigation apps. The source compares a few, like Move It and City Mapper, and they made this really interesting point about ads.
They did. This is a great example of where a generic design can create a huge barrier.
Yeah.
So the source mentions Move It has fantastic coverage, 3,500 cities, but the free version has ads.
Yeah, nothing induces panic like a loud flashing pop-up ad when you're desperately trying to figure out which stop to get off at.
Exactly. It just breaks your focus. And that's why the source highlights an app like City Mapper. It has a get off now vibration alert.
Oh, a tactile cue.
That tactile cue is great because you don't have to stare at the screen constantly, which actually makes you look less vulnerable. And it has a visual countdown timer.
Why is the timer so important?
For many autistic individuals, the abstract concept of soon is really anxiety inducing. Seeing 5 minutes to arrival is concrete. It manages their expectations and reduces the cognitive load.
One of the most practical tips in the source was about communication. What happens if the teen needs to ask for help, but they just freeze up?
This is a huge, huge barrier. A teen might be highly verbal at home, but in a moment of high stress or sensory overload, they might just lose the ability to formulate sentences. They can go nonverbal.
So script cards.
Yes. Pre-written text templates on their phone or, you know, even physical laminated cards. A card that says, I have autism and I am lost. Please tell me which bus goes to Main Street.
It just removes that pressure of having to construct a sentence on the fly.
It empowers them to advocate for themselves even when their brain is in fight or flight mode. It's a really simple, low-tech tool that solves a high-tech brain problem.
And finally, the ultimate backup. We kind of circle back to that locator device, because even with the shadowing and the script cards, sometimes things just go wrong.
Right. Even with the best planning, sometimes they just get on the wrong bus. Or the bus breaks down and everyone has to get off in a neighborhood they don't recognize.
And that is the nightmare scenario. That's the phone call every parent just dreads.
It is. And this is where that AngelSense device comes back in as the ultimate safety net. If the teen panics, the parent can see exactly where they are on the live map. They don't have to call and ask that terrible question, "Where are you?"
Because if they knew where they were, they wouldn't be lost.
Exactly. Instead, the parent can activate the voice feature and say, "Okay, honey, I see you. You're at the corner of 5th and Elm. You're safe. Just stay right there on that bench. I'm calling an Uber for you right now."
It just turns a crisis into a manageable problem.
It acts as a remote co-pilot. It's not a helicopter parent hovering over them, you know, preventing them from living. It's a co-pilot who only grabs the controls when the plane is actually going down.
So let's zoom out. What does all this mean? We've looked at the wandering risks for younger kids, the transit challenges for teens, and the specific tech that can bridge that gap.
I think the synthesis here is really about redefining what we mean by independence. We often think of independence as doing it all by yourself.
Right, alone.
But for families with autistic children, and honestly for all of us, real independence is about having the confidence to engage with the world.
And the technology, the geofencing, the speakerphones, the apps. Yeah. It's not about restriction.
No, it's an enabler. It allows the parent to unclench that knot of anxiety in their chest just enough to say, "Okay, go ahead, go to the park, take the bus to the movies."
It's the confidence to let go.
Precisely. Whether it's a 6-year-old at school or a 16-year-old on the subway, the goal is the same. Providing a safety net that is so strong that it becomes invisible, allowing the child to shine.
And that is a really beautiful place to land.
It really is.
Before we sign off, here's something for you to think about. We usually view technology as something that distances us, you know? Heads in our screens, disconnected. But in this case, does the safety net of technology actually make the most human connection of all, which is trust, possible?
That's a powerful thought.
True independence might actually require the strongest support system.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive.
Stay curious.
See you next time.